That could prove embarrassing.
Not if you stick to the simple line that you were my professional advisor when it came to stocks and shares, and that I didn't show a great deal of interest in the details, as I trusted your judgment.
But if I were to do that, someone might suggest it was me who was trying to bring the company down.
If they were stupid enough to try that line of questioning, Sir Edward would remind the judge that it's not you who is on trial, and because you're a Member of Parliament, Mr. Trelford would quickly back off.
And you say Sir Edward is certain you can't lose?
Asked Fisher, not sounding convinced.
As long as we all stick to the party line, he says we're home and dry.
And he doesn't think it's likely they'll call me.
He'd be surprised if they did. But I do feel, continued Virginia, that if, as Sir Edward suggested, I'm likely to be awarded 50,000, we should split it down the middle. I've asked my lawyers to draw up an agreement to that effect.
That's most generous, Virginia.
No more than you deserve, Alex.
Chapter 32. Sebastian was sitting in the bath when the phone rang. Only one person would have considered calling him at that hour in the morning. Should he jump out of the bath and run into the hall, leaving a small stream in his wake? Or should he get on with washing himself, as his mother was sure to call again in a few minutes' time? He stayed put. He was right. The phone went again while he was in the middle of shaving. This time he walked out into the hall and picked up the receiver.
"Good morning, Mother,"
he said, before she'd had a chance to speak.
"Sorry to call you so early, Seb, but I need your advice. How do you think I should vote when Desmond Mellor stands for deputy chairman? I haven't changed my mind since we discussed this subject last night, Mother."
"If you vote against Mellor and he wins, that will undermine your position. If you abstain and the vote's tied, you'll still have the casting vote. But if you vote for him..."
"I would never do that."
"Then you have two choices. Personally, I'd vote against, so that if he loses, he'll have no choice but to resign. By the way, Ross Buchanan doesn't agree with me. He thinks you should abstain and keep your options open. But I don't have to remind you what happened the last time you did that, when Fisher stood for chairman."
"It's different this time. Mellor's given me his word that he won't vote for himself."
"In writing?"
"No,"
admitted Emma. "Then it's not a word I'd rely on."
"Yes, but if I..."
"Mum, if I don't finish shaving, you won't even get my vote."
"Yes, sorry. I'll think about what you said. See you at the board meeting."
Seb smiled as he put the phone down. What a complete waste of time that was, when he knew she'd already decided to abstain. He checked his watch, just enough time to grab a bowl of muesli and boil himself an egg.
"What did he say?"
asked Harry, as he passed his wife a cup of tea.
"He said I should vote against, but that Ross thinks I should abstain, so I'm none the wiser."
"But only last night you told me you were confident of winning."
"By 6-4, even if I abstain."
"Then I think you should abstain."
"Why?"
"Because I agree with Ross. If you vote against Mellor and lose, it would make your position untenable. However, I'm beginning to think I should postpone my trip to Leningrad until we know the outcome."
"But if you don't go today," said Emma, "you'll have to wait at least 6 months before you can get another visa. Whereas if you go now, you'll be back well in time for the trial."
"But if you were to lose the vote today..."
"I'm not going to lose, Harry. 6 of the directors have given me their word, so there's nothing to worry about. And you gave your word to Mrs. Babakoff, so you must keep it. In any case, it will be nothing less than a personal triumph when you come home with a copy of Uncle Joe under your arm. So start packing."
Sebastian was putting on his jacket and heading for the door when the phone rang for a third time. He looked at his watch, 7:56, and thought about ignoring it, but turned back, grabbed the phone and said,
"I haven't got time, Mother."
"It's not your mother," said Rachel.
"I thought you ought to know that I had a call just after you left the office last night, and I wouldn't have bothered you if she hadn't said it was urgent. I've already called a couple of times this morning, but you were engaged.
She, said Seb.
A woman called Dr. Rosemary Wolfe, phoning from the States, said you'd know who she was.
I most certainly do. Did she leave any message?
No, just a number. 202-555-0319. But Seb, don't forget, they're 5 hours behind us, so it's only 3 in the morning in Washington.
Thanks, Rachel.
Gotta dash, or I'll be late for the Barringtons' board meeting.
Jim Knowles joined Desmond Mellor for breakfast at the Avon Gorge Hotel.
It's going to be close, said Knowles as he sat down opposite Mellor, who stopped speaking while a waitress poured him a coffee.
My latest calculation is 5 votes each.
Who's changed their mind since yesterday?
Asked Mellor.
Carrick. I convinced him of the importance of having a deputy chairman in place while Mrs. Clifton is tied up in a trial that could last for a month, perhaps even longer.
Is her vote included in the 5?
No, because I'm fairly sure she'll abstain.
I wouldn't, if I were in her position. And if we win the first vote, what about the second?
The second should be easier, as long as you stick to the line that you think it will be for no more than a month. Even the waverers should go along with that.
A month will be more than enough to make sure she never returns. But if she loses the trial, it all becomes academic, because then she'll have to resign. Either way, my bet is you'll be chairman a month from today. In which case, Jim, you'll be my deputy. Any news from Virginia on how her case is shaping up?
Asked Knowles.
She rang me yesterday evening. Apparently her barrister has assured her that she can't possibly lose.
I've never known a barrister say that before, said Knowles, especially when Alex Fisher might be called as a witness, because I can tell you from past experience, he's not good under fire.
Virginia tells me that Sir Edward doesn't intend to call him, rather proving my point. But once she's won the case, everything should fall neatly into place. That's assuming you've paid Arnold Hardcastle for his mother's shares.
Not yet. I don't intend to cough up until the last possible moment. Even I can't afford that sort of outlay for any longer than necessary.
Why not ask Sloane to advance you a short-term loan to cover it?
I wish I could. But it's against the law for a bank to make a loan for the purpose of buying its own shares. No, I'll get all my money back and make a handsome profit once Bishara completes his part of the deal. If Sloane gets his timing right, it will be a double whammy, because he'll stay on as chairman of the bank, and I'll be the new chairman of Barrington's.
That's assuming we win today, said Knowles.
Once Sebastian had escaped the rush hour traffic and turned onto the A40, he checked the clock on his dashboard. He still had a couple of hours to spare, but he didn't need any more hold-ups. At that moment, a red light on the dashboard came on, and the petrol indicator began to flicker, which meant he was down to his last gallon. A road sign informed him the next service station was 21 miles away. He knew there was something he'd meant to do last night. He moved across to the inside lane and maintained a steady 50 miles an hour so he could eke out every last drop of what was left in the tank. He began to pray. Surely the gods weren't on Mellor's side.
Who are you calling? Asked Harry as he zipped up his overnight bag. Giles, I'd like to see if he agrees with Ross or Seb. After all, he's still the largest shareholder in the company.
Harry wondered if he should unpack.
And don't forget your overcoat, said Emma.
Sir Giles Barrington's office. Good morning, Polly, it's Emma Clifton. Could I have a word with my brother? I'm afraid not, Mrs. Clifton. He's abroad at the moment. Somewhere exciting, I hope.
Not exactly, said Polly. East Berlin.
Seb began to relax when he came off the motorway and drove up the ramp into the petrol station. Once he'd filled up, he realised just how close it must have been. He handed over a £10 note for the 12 gallons and waited for his change. He was back on the motorway at 9:36. The first sign to Bristol read 61 miles, so he was confident he would still make it with time to spare. He moved into the outside lane, pleased to see a long stretch of open road ahead of him. His mind drifted from Dr. Wolfe, and what could possibly be urgent enough for her to phone him, to his mother and how she would vote, to Desmond Mellor and what last-minute tricks he would stoop to, and then back to Samantha. Was it possible? When he heard the siren, he assumed it was an ambulance and quickly moved across to the inside lane, but when he looked in his rearview mirror, he saw a police car with lights flashing, bearing down on him. He slowed down, willing it to shoot past, but it drew up alongside him, and the driver indicated that he should pull over onto the hard shoulder. Reluctantly, he obeyed. The police car pulled up in front of him, and two policemen climbed out and walked slowly towards him. The first was carrying a thick leather notebook, the second what looked like a briefcase. Seb wound down the window and smiled. "Good morning, officers."
"Good morning, sir. Were you aware that you were travelling at almost 90 miles an hour?"
"No, I wasn't," admitted Seb. "I'm very sorry."
"Could I see your driving licence, sir?"
Seb opened the glove compartment, took out his licence, and handed it to the policeman, who studied it for some time before saying,
"Will you be kind enough to step out of the car, sir?"
Seb got out as the other policeman opened his briefcase and extracted a large yellow balloon-like bag attached to a tube.
"This is a breathalyzer, sir, and I have to ask you if you're willing to be tested to see if you're above the legal limit."
"At 10 o'clock in the morning?"
"It's standard procedure for a speeding offence. If you choose not to do so, I shall have to ask you to accompany me to the nearest police station."
"That won't be necessary, officer. I'm quite happy to take the test."
He carried out the instructions to the letter, well aware that he'd only had 2 Campari and sodas the previous night. Once he'd blown into the tube twice, evidently he didn't blow hard enough the first time, the two officers studied the orange indicator for some time, before one of them pronounced,
"No problem there, sir. You're well below the limit."
"Thank God for that,"
said Seb, climbing back into his car.
"Just a moment, sir. We're not quite finished. We still have a couple of forms to fill in. Your name, please, sir?"
"But I'm in a hurry,"
said Seb, regretting his words the moment he'd said them.
"We gathered that, sir."
"Sebastian Clifton."
"Home address?"
When the officer had finally filled in the answer to the last question, he handed Seb a speeding ticket, saluted, and said,
"Have a good day, sir, and please drive more carefully in the future."
Sebastian glanced desperately at the little clock on the dashboard, but it faithfully recorded the correct time. In 40 minutes, his mother would be calling the board meeting to order, and he couldn't help remembering that the election of a new deputy chairman was the first item on the agenda. Lady Virginia took her time telling Sir Edward what really happened on the first morning of the Buckingham's maiden voyage.
"Fascinating," he said, "but it's not something we can use in evidence."
"Why not? Mrs. Clifton wouldn't be able to deny it, and then she'd have to resign as chairman of Barrington's, and we couldn't lose the case."
"Possibly not, but the judge would rule the evidence as inadmissible, and that's not the only reason we couldn't use it."
"What more do you need?" asked Virginia.
"A witness who wasn't dismissed for being drunk on duty, and who clearly bears a grudge against the company, and a director who would be willing to stand in the witness box and give evidence under oath."
"But it's no more than the truth."
"It may well be. But tell me, Lady Virginia, have you read Harry Clifton's latest novel?"
"Certainly not."
"Then be thankful that I have. Because in Inspector Warwick and the Time Bomb, you will find almost word for word the story you've just told me. And you can be sure that at least 1 or 2 members of the jury will also have read it."
"But surely that would only strengthen our case."
"More likely we'd be laughed out of court."
Emma looked slowly around the table. Every director was in place, except Sebastian. But never in her 11 years as chairman of Barrington's had she failed to begin a meeting on time. Philip Webster, the company secretary, opened proceedings by reading the minutes of the previous meeting. Far too quickly, in Emma's opinion.
"Are there any matters arising from the minutes?"
she asked hopefully. There were none.
"So, let us move on. To item number one, the election of a deputy chairman. Desmond Mellor has been proposed by Jim Knowles and seconded by Clive Anskott. Before I call for a vote, does anyone have any questions?"
Mellor shook his head, and Knowles said nothing, both well aware that Sebastian Clifton might appear at any moment. Emma stared hopefully at the Admiral, but he looked as if he'd fallen asleep.
"I think we've all had more than enough time to consider our position," said Anskott.
"I agree," said Knowles. "Let's get on with the vote."
"Before we do so," said Emma, "perhaps Mr. Mellor would care to address the board on why he feels he's the right man to be deputy chairman of Barrington's."
"I don't think that will be necessary," said Mellor, who had spent some considerable time preparing a speech, which he now had no intention of delivering. "I leave my record to speak for itself."
As Emma had now run out of delaying tactics, she was left with no choice but to call on the company secretary to carry out the roll call. Webster rose from his place and read out the names of each director, starting with the chairman, Mrs. Clifton.
"I shall abstain," said Emma.
"Mr. Maynard? 4. Mr. Dixon? Against. Mr. Anskott? 4. Mr. Knowles? 4. Mr. Dobbs? Against."
He too had kept his word. Emma kept looking towards the door.
"Mr. Carrick? 4.
Emma looked surprised. The last time they'd spoken, Carrick had given her his assurance that he wouldn't be supporting Mellor, who had been the last person to sit on that particular cushion, she wondered.
"Admiral Summers?" "Against."
Not a man to desert his friends.
"Mr. Clifton?"
Webster looked around the table and, satisfied that Sebastian wasn't present, wrote "absent" by his name.
"Mr. Bingham?" "Against."
No surprise. He disliked Mellor almost as much as she did. Emma smiled. For all. As chairman, she wouldn't hesitate to exercise her casting vote to stop Mellor becoming deputy chairman.
"And finally, Mr. Mellor," said the company secretary.
4,
he said firmly. Emma was momentarily stunned. But turning to Mellor, she eventually managed,
"You told me only yesterday that you would be abstaining, which is why I did so myself. Had I known of this change of heart?"
"Since I spoke to you yesterday evening," said Mellor, "one or two of my colleagues have pointed out that the company's statutes allow a board member to vote for himself when standing for office. Reluctantly, I allowed them to convince me that I should do so."
"But you gave me your word."
"I did call you at home several times this morning, Chairman, but the line was always busy."
Not something Emma was able to contradict. She sank back into her chair. Mr. Webster carefully double-checked the list, but Emma already knew the result and its consequences. "By a vote of 5-4, Mr. Mellor is elected Deputy Chairman." Some people around the table smiled and said, "Hear, hear." Others remained silent. Seb had been right. She should have voted against Mellor in the first place, and then she could have defeated him with her casting vote. But where was Seb, whose vote would have made that unnecessary? How could he have let her down when she most needed him? And then she froze and stopped being the chairman of a public company and reverted to being a mother. Was it possible her son had been involved in another dreadful accident? Emma couldn't bear the thought of going through all that again. She'd far rather lose the vote than...
"Item number 2, said the company secretary. "To select a launch date for the MV Balmoral and for the opening of the first booking period for her maiden voyage to New York. Before we move on to item 2, said Mellor, rising from his place to deliver a speech that had also been well prepared, I consider it nothing less than my duty to remind the board that Mrs. Clifton is about to face a most unpleasant trial that has already attracted considerable media attention. Of course, we all hope and expect that our chairman will be able to dismiss the serious charges levelled against her. However, should Lady Virginia Fenwick succeed in proving her case, obviously Mrs. Clifton would have to consider her position. With that in mind, it might be prudent for her to temporarily, and I stress the word temporarily, step down as chairman until the trial is over. He paused for a moment and looked at each of his fellow directors in turn before adding, I hope it won't be necessary to call a vote on this occasion. Emma could sense that if it was put to a vote, the board were, with one or two exceptions, broadly in agreement with the new deputy chairman's proposal. She gathered up her things and quietly left the room. Mellor was about to move into her chair when Admiral Summers rose from his place and fixed him with a stare as if he were a German U-boat commander before saying,
This is not the board I joined 20 years ago, and I no longer care to be a member of it.
As he left the room, Bob Bingham and David Dixon joined him. When the door closed behind them, Mellor turned to Knowles and said,
That's a bonus I hadn't anticipated.
Sebastian Clifton, 1970. Chapter 33.
What do I tell your father when he phones to ask me how the board meeting went? The truth. He'll expect nothing less. But if I do, he'll turn around and come straight back home. Why, where is he? At Heathrow, waiting to board a flight to Leningrad. How unlike him to leave when it's my fault. I told him we couldn't possibly lose the vote, and he took my word for it. And we wouldn't have done if I'd arrived on time. True enough. Perhaps it would have been more sensible if you'd come down the night before, said Emma.
And if you'd taken my advice, none of this would have happened, snapped Seb. Both of them remained silent for some time.
How important is Dad's trip to Leningrad? Every bit as important as this morning's vote was for me. He's been preparing for it for weeks. And if he doesn't go now, he won't get another chance for a very long time, if ever. Anyway, he's only going to be away for a couple of days.
She looked at her son.
Perhaps you could take the call when he phones.
And say what?
Asked Seb.
If he asks me how the meeting went, I'll have to tell him the truth, otherwise he'll never trust me again.
He brought the car to a halt outside the manor house.
What time did you say he was likely to call? His flight's at 4, so I suppose it will be sometime around 3.
Seb looked at his watch.
Don't worry, I'll come up with something by then.
Harry didn't need to check in his luggage because he'd only brought an overnight bag. He knew exactly what he needed to do from the moment he landed, and he would have more than enough time to fine-tune his plan on the long flight across the continent. If the impossible had happened and Emma had lost the vote, then it wouldn't matter anyway, because he'd be taking the next train back to Bristol.
This is the first call for all passengers on BOEC flight 726 to Leningrad. Would you please make your way to gate number 3, where the flight is now boarding?
Harry strode across to the nearest phone booth, clutching a handful of coins. He dialed his home number and fed in enough money to allow him 3 minutes.
Bristol 4313,
said a voice he recognized immediately.
Seb, hi, what are you doing at home?
Helping Mum celebrate.
I'll go and get her so she can tell you the good news herself.
This is the second call for passengers travelling to Leningrad on BOAC flight number...
Hello, darling, said Emma. I'm so glad you called, because...
The line went dead.
Emma, are you there?
There was no reply.
Emma!
He tried again. But there was still no response, and he didn't have enough coins left over to call a second time.
This is the third and final call for passengers on BOAC flight 726 to Leningrad.
Harry replaced the receiver, trying to recall Seb's exact words.
Helping Mum celebrate.
I'll go and get her so she can tell you the good news herself. When Emma had come on the line, she had sounded unusually cheerful. She must have won the vote, Harry concluded. Despite this, he hesitated for a moment.
Would Mr. Harry Clifton please make his way to gate number 3 as the gate is about to close?
What are we celebrating?
Asked Emma.
I don't know, said Seb, but I'll think of something by the time Dad gets back from Russia. But for now, we have to concentrate on more immediate problems. There's not much we can do until the trial is over. Mother, you must stop acting like a girl guide and begin to think like Mellor and Knowles. And what are they thinking at this moment? That it couldn't have gone better for them if they'd planned it. Not only did they get rid of you, but 3 of your most trusted lieutenants at the same time. 3 honourable men, said Emma. Just like Brutus. And look where that got him. I wish I'd still been in the boardroom when Admiral Summers... You're back in your girl guide uniform, Mother. Now snap out of it and listen carefully. The first thing you must do is ring Admiral Summers, Bob Bingham and Mr. Dixon and tell them that under no circumstances are they to resign from the board. But they walked out, Seb. Knowles and Mellor won't give a damn why they did. But I do give a damn. Because I only care about the 3 votes we would sacrifice for the sake of a pointless gesture. If they were to remain on the board, with my vote, yours and Dobbs's, we'd have 6 votes to their 5. But I won't be in the chair again until after the trial. Have you forgotten that I stood down? No, you didn't. You just walked out of the meeting, so you can walk back in again. Because if you don't, you won't be chairman after the trial, win or lose. You're a devious individual, Sebastian Clifton. And as long as Mellor and Knowles don't work that out, we're still in with a chance. But first, you've got 3 calls to make. Because believe me, Mellor and Knowles will only ever accept defeat if we win every vote. Perhaps you should be chairman, said Emma. All in good time, Mother. But what I need you to do now is get straight on the phone to Admiral Summers, because he's probably already written his resignation letter. Let's just hope he hasn't posted it. Emma picked up the phone book and began flicking through the S's. And if you need me for anything, I'll be in the library making a long-distance call, said Seb.
Adrian Sloane was standing in the entrance hall of Farthing's Bank at 11:05. No one could remember the chairman ever coming down to meet a guest before. Mr. Bashara's Bentley drew up outside the bank 4 minutes later, and a doorman rushed across to open the car's back door. As Bashara and his 2 colleagues entered the building, Sloane stepped forward to greet him.
Good morning, Mr. Bashara, he said as they shook hands. Welcome to your bank.
Thank you, Mr. Sloane. I'm sure you'll remember Mr. Morland, my lawyer, and Mr. Piddy, my chief accountant.
Of course, said Sloane, shaking hands with both men. He then guided his guests towards a waiting lift, as the staff burst into well-rehearsed applause to welcome their new president. Bashara gave a slight bow and smiled at the 3 young porters who stood behind the reception desk.
That's where I began my banking career, he said to Sloane as he stepped into the lift.
And now you're about to become the owner of one of the city's most respected financial institutions.
A day I have looked forward to for many years, admitted Bashara.
A statement that made Sloane feel even more confident that he could forge ahead with his change of plan.
When we reach the executive floor, we'll go straight through to the boardroom, where the offer documents have been prepared and await your signature.
Thank you, said Bashara,
as he stepped out into the corridor. When he entered the boardroom, the bank's 8 directors rose as one and waited for him to take his place at the head of the table before they sat back down. A butler served Bashara with a cup of his favourite Turkish coffee, black and steaming hot, and 2 McVitie's shortbread biscuits. Also his favourite. Nothing had been left to chance. Sloane took a seat at the other end of the table.
On behalf of the board, Mr. Bashara, allow me to welcome you to Farthing's Bank. With your permission, I will take you through the procedure for the exchange of ownership.
Bishara smiled, took out his fountain pen, and placed it on the table. In front of you are three copies of the offer document, as approved by your lawyers. Both sides have made small emendations, but nothing of any real consequence. Mr. Morland nodded his agreement. I thought it might be helpful, continued Sloane, if I were to highlight the most important issues we have agreed on. You will become the president of Farthing's Bank and can nominate three directors to represent you on the board, one of whom would be appointed deputy chairman. Bishara smiled. They weren't going to like who he had in mind for deputy chairman. I will remain as chairman for a period of 5 years, and the eight board members present here today will also have their contracts renewed for a further 5 years. And finally, the sum agreed upon for the takeover is £29,800,000, which values each share at £5. Bishara turned to his lawyer, who handed him a banker's draft for the full amount. He placed it on the table in front of him. The sight of it almost caused Sloane to change his mind. However, said Sloane, something has arisen in the past 24 hours that has made it necessary to make a small adjustment to the contract. Bishara could have been playing backgammon at the Clermont for all Sloane could tell from the expression on his face. Yesterday morning, continued Sloane, we had a call from a well-established city institution which offered us £6 a share. In order to prove their credibility, they placed the full amount in escrow with their solicitors. This offer placed me and the board in a most invidious position, as we are no more than the servants of our shareholders. However, we held a board meeting earlier this morning, and it was unanimously agreed that if you were able to match the offer of £6 a share, we would dismiss the rival bid and honour our original agreement. We have therefore adjusted the offer document to show this change, and have entered the new figure of £35,760,000. Sloane gave Bishara an ingratiating smile and added, given the circumstances, I hope you will consider this an acceptable solution. Bishara smiled.
Firstly, Mr. Sloane, allow me to thank you for your courtesy in giving me this opportunity to equal the counterbid made by a third party.
Sloane smiled.
However, I must point out that we agreed on the sum of £5 a share almost a month ago, and as I put down a deposit with my solicitors in good faith, this comes as something of a surprise.
Yes, I must apologize for that, said Sloane. But you will understand the dilemma I faced, remembering that we have a fiduciary duty to our stockholders.
I don't know what your father did for a living, Mr. Sloane, said Bishara, but mine was a carpet trader in Istanbul, and one of the many things he taught me in my youth was that once a price had been agreed upon, coffee was served, and you then sat around for some time pretending to like each other. The equivalent of an Englishman's handshake, followed by lunch at his club. So, my offer of £5 a share is still on the table, and if you decide to take it up, I will happily sign the agreement.
All eight board members turned and looked at the chairman, willing him to accept Bishara's offer. But Sloane simply smiled, convinced that the carpet trader's son was bluffing.
If that is your final offer, Mr. Bishara, I fear I will have to accept the counterbid. I only hope that we can part as friends.
The eight directors turned their attention to the other end of the table. One of them was sweating.
Clearly, the morals of city bankers are not those I was taught sitting at my father's feet in the bazaars of Istanbul. Therefore, Mr. Sloane, you have left me with no choice but to withdraw my offer.
Sloane's lips began to quiver as Bishara handed the banker's draft back to his lawyer, rose slowly from his place and said,
Good day, gentlemen. I wish you a long and successful relationship with your new owner, whoever that might be.
Bishara left the boardroom flanked by his two advisers. He did not speak again until they were seated in the back of his Bentley, when he leant forward and said to his driver,
"Change of plan, Fred. I need to call Kaufman's Bank."
"Could you put me through to Dr. Wolf?" said Seb.
"Who is calling?"
"Sebastian Clifton."
"Mr. Clifton, how kind of you to call back. I only wish it were in happier circumstances."
Seb's legs gave way, and he collapsed into the chair behind his father's desk, desperate to find out if anything had happened to Samantha or Jessica.
"Sadly," continued Dr. Wolf, "Samantha's husband, Michael, recently suffered a stroke while on a flight from Chicago back to Washington."
"I'm very sorry to hear that."
"By the time they got the poor man to a hospital, he had lapsed into a coma. How differently things might have turned out if it had happened an hour earlier or an hour later. This all took place some weeks ago, and his doctors are not optimistic about his recovery. In fact, they have no way of knowing how long he will remain in his present state, but that was not the purpose of my call. I'm guessing that it's Jessica you called about and not her stepfather." "You're right. The truth is that medical bills in this country are quite horrendous, and although Mr. Brewer held a high-ranking post in the State Department and was well covered by his health insurance, the expense of the round-the-clock nursing his condition requires has resulted in Samantha deciding to withdraw Jessica from Jefferson Elementary at the end of this term, as she can no longer afford our fees. I'll cover them."
"That is most generous of you, Mr. Clifton. However, I should tell you that our fees are $1,500 a semester, and Jessica's extracurricular activities last semester came to a further $302. I'll wire you $2,000 immediately, and then perhaps you'll be kind enough to bill me at the end of every semester. However, that is on condition that neither Samantha nor Jessica ever finds out that I'm involved in any way." "I had a feeling you might say that, Mr. Clifton. And I think I've come up with a strategy that would protect your anonymity. If you were to endow an art scholarship with an annual donation of, say, $5,000, it would then be up to me to select which pupils should be the beneficiary."
"A nice solution," said Seb.
"I feel sure your English master would have approved of your correct use of the word nice."
"My father, actually," said Seb.
"Which reminds me, when my sister needed canvases, paints, drawing paper, brushes, or even pencils, my father always made sure they were of the highest quality. He used to say it mustn't be our fault if she didn't succeed. I want the same for my daughter. So if $5,000 isn't enough, Dr. Wolf, don't hesitate to give her anything she needs and I'll cover the extra costs. But I repeat, neither mother nor daughter must ever find out who made this possible."
"It won't be the first secret of yours I've kept, Mr. Clifton."
"I apologize," said Seb, "and also for my next question. When do you retire, Dr. Wolf?"
"Not long after your daughter will have won the Hunter Prize scholarship to the American College of Art, which will be a first for Jefferson Elementary."
Chapter 34 Harry was checking his traveller's checks when the stewardess began her final round, making sure the first-class passengers had fastened their seatbelts as the plane began its descent into Leningrad.
"Excuse me," said Harry. "Do you know when your next flight back to London is?"
"This aircraft has a 4-hour turnaround and is scheduled to return to London at 9:10 this evening."
"That's a bit rough on you, isn't it?"
"No," she said, suppressing a smile. "We always have a stopover in Leningrad, so if you were to return on this evening's flight, you'd be served by a completely different crew."
"Thank you," said Harry. "That's most helpful."
He looked out of the cabin window to watch Tolstoy's favourite city looming larger by the second, although he suspected the great author would have been appalled by its change of name. As he heard the hydraulics lowering the wheels into place, he wondered if there would be enough time for him to carry out his shopping spree and be back on board before the cabin door was locked. When the wheels touched the ground, Harry felt a surge of adrenaline he'd only previously experienced when he'd been behind enemy lines during the war. He sometimes forgot that was nearly 30 years ago, when he was a stone lighter and a whole lot nimbler. Well, at least this time he wouldn't be expected to face a regiment of Germans advancing towards him. After leaving Mrs. Babakoff, he had committed everything she had said to memory. He hadn't written anything down for fear of someone discovering what he had planned. He had told no one other than Emma the real reason he was visiting Leningrad, although Giles had worked out that he must be going there to collect the book, although collect was the wrong verb. As the plane bumped along the potholed runway, he estimated that it would be at least an hour before he cleared customs and was able to convert some sterling into the local currency. In fact, it took an hour and 14 minutes, despite his only having an overnight bag and exchanging £10 for 25 rubles. He then had to join the end of a long taxi queue because the Russians hadn't quite got the hang of free enterprise.
"The corner of Nevsky Prospect and Bolshaya Morskaya Street,"
he instructed the driver in his native tongue, hoping he would know where it was. All those hours learning Russian, when in truth he would only need a few well-honed phrases, as he intended to be on his way back to England in a few hours, mission completed, as his old commanding officer would say. During the drive into the city, they passed the Yusupov Palace, when Harry's thoughts turned to Rasputin. The arch-manipulator might have enjoyed his little subterfuge. Harry only hoped he wouldn't end up being poisoned, wrapped in a carpet, and then dropped through an ice hole in the Malaya Nevka River. He realized that if he was going to be back at the airport in time to board the 2110 to Heathrow, he would only have 20 or 30 minutes to spare, but that should be more than enough. The taxi driver stopped outside an antiquarian bookshop and pointed to the meter. Harry took out a 5-ruble note and handed it to him.
"I don't expect to be long, so would you be kind enough to wait?"
The driver pocketed the note and gave him a curt nod. The moment Harry stepped inside the shop, he could see why Mrs. Babakoff had chosen this particular establishment in which to secrete her treasure. It was almost as if they didn't want to sell anything. An elderly woman was seated behind the counter, her head in a book. Harry smiled at her, but she didn't even look up when the bell rang above the door. He took a couple of books down from a nearby shelf and pretended to peruse them as he edged his way slowly to the back of the shop, his heart beating a little faster with each step he took. Would it still be there? Had someone already bought it, only to discover when they got home that they'd got the wrong book? Had another customer captured the prize and destroyed Uncle Joe for fear they might be caught with it? He could think of a dozen reasons why the 3,000-mile round trip could turn out to be a wasted journey. But for the moment, hope still triumphed over expectation. When he finally reached the bookcase on which Mrs. Babakoff had said she'd hidden her husband's work, he closed his eyes and prayed. He opened his eyes to find that Tess of the D'Urbervilles was no longer in its place, just a gap covered with a thin layer of dust between A Tale of Two Cities and Daniel Deronda. Mrs. Babakoff had made no mention of Daniel Deronda. He glanced back towards the counter to see the old woman turning a page. Standing on tiptoe, he stretched up and eased A Tale of Two Cities off the top shelf, accompanied by a shower of dust that sprinkled down on him. When he opened it, he thought he might have a heart attack, because it was not a copy of Dickens's work, but a slim volume by Anatoly Babakov. Not wishing to draw attention to his prize, he took two other novels from the same shelf, Greenmantle by John Buchan and Jamaica Inn by Daphne du Maurier, and pretended to browse as he made his way slowly towards the counter. He almost felt guilty interrupting the old woman as he placed the three books on the counter in front of her. She opened each of them in turn and checked the prices. Mrs. Babakoff had even penciled in the price. If she turned one more page, he would have been caught. She didn't. Using her fingers as an adding machine, she said,
8 rubles.
Harry handed her 2 5-ruble notes, having been warned when he was in Moscow for the conference the shopkeepers had to report anyone who attempted to purchase goods with foreign currency, and, more important, that they were to refuse the sale and confiscate the money. He thanked her as she handed him his change. By the time he left the shop, she turned another page.
"Back to the airport," said Harry, as he climbed into the waiting taxi.
The driver looked surprised, but swung obediently round and set out on the return journey. Harry opened the book once again to check that it hadn't been an illusion. The thrill of the chase was replaced by a feeling of triumph. He turned to the first page and began reading. All those hours spent studying Russian were finally proving worthwhile. He turned the page. An early evening traffic jam meant the journey back to the airport took far longer than he'd originally anticipated. He began to check his watch every few minutes, fearful that he might miss the plane. By the time the taxi dropped him at the airport, he had reached Chapter 7 and the death of Stalin's second wife. He handed another 5 rubles to the driver and didn't wait for the change, but ran into the airport and followed the signs for the BOAC counter.
"Can you get me on the 9:10 back to London?"
"First or economy?"
asked the booking clerk.
"First."
"Window or aisle?"
"A window, please."
6A,
she said, handing him a ticket. It amused Harry that he would be flying back in the same seat he'd occupied for the incoming flight.
"Do you have any luggage to check in, sir?"
"No, just this," he said, holding up his bag.
"The flight is due to take off shortly, sir, so it might be wise to make your way through to customs."
Harry wondered how many times a day she delivered that particular line. He was happy to obey her suggestion, and as he passed a bank of telephones, his thoughts turned to Emma and Mrs. Babakov. But he would have to wait until he was back in London before he could tell them the news. He was only a couple of strides away from passport control when he felt a firm hand on his shoulder. He turned to find 2 heavily built young policemen standing on either side of him.
"Would you come with me?"
said one of the officers, confident that Harry spoke Russian.
"Why?" asked Harry. "I'm on my way back to London, and I don't want to miss my flight."
"We just need to check your bag. If there are no irregularities, you'll have more than enough time to catch your flight."
Harry prayed they were looking for drugs, cash, or contraband as they gripped him firmly by the arm and led him away. He considered making a dash for it. Perhaps 20 years ago. The policeman stopped outside an unmarked door, unlocked it, and shoved Harry inside. The door slammed behind him, and he heard a key turning in the lock. He looked around the room. A small table, 2 chairs, and no windows. Nothing on the walls other than a large black-and-white photograph of Comrade Brezhnev, chairman of the party. Moments later, he heard the key turning in the lock again. Harry already had half a story prepared about having come to St. Petersburg to visit the Hermitage. The door opened and a man entered. The sight of this tall, elegantly dressed officer caused Harry to feel apprehensive for the first time. He was wearing a dark green uniform with 3 gold stars on his epaulettes and too many medals on his chest to suggest that he might be easily intimidated. 2 very different men followed him in, whose appearance seemed to disprove Darwin's theory of evolution.
"Mr. Clifton, my name is Colonel Marinkin, and I am the officer in charge of this investigation. Please open your bag."
Harry unzipped the bag and stood back.
"Place all the contents on the table."
Harry took out his wash bag, a pair of pants, a pair of socks, a cream shirt, just in case he had to stay overnight, and 3 books. The colonel only seemed interested in the books, which he studied for a few moments before placing 2 of them back on the table.
"You may pack your bag, Mr. Clifton."
Harry let out a long sigh as he returned his belongings to the bag. At least the whole exercise hadn't been a complete waste of time. He knew the book existed, and he'd even read 7 chapters. Which he would write out on the plane.
"Are you aware of what this book is?"
asked the colonel, holding it up.
"A Tale of 2 Cities,
said Harry.
"Among my favourites, but not considered to be Dickens's masterpiece."
Don't play games with me, said Marinkin. We are not the complete fools you arrogant English take us for. This book, as you well know, is Uncle Joe by Anatoly Babakov, which you have been trying to get hold of for some years. Today, you almost succeeded. You planned everything down to the finest detail. First, you visit Mrs. Babakov in Pittsburgh to learn where she had hidden the book. On returning to Bristol, you brush up your Russian, even impressing your tutor with your grasp of our language. You then fly to Leningrad just a few days before your visa is due to expire. You enter the country carrying only an overnight bag, the contents of which suggest you didn't plan even to stay overnight. And you change just £10 into rubles. You ask a taxi driver to take you to an obscure antiquarian bookshop in the center of the city. You purchase 3 books, 2 of which you could have picked up in any bookshop in England. You ask the driver to take you back to the airport, and you check yourself in on the next flight home, even the same seat. Who do you imagine you're fooling? No, Mr. Clifton, your luck has run out, and I'm placing you under arrest.
On what charge? Asked Harry. Buying a book.
Save it for the trial, Mr. Clifton.
Would those passengers traveling to London on BOAC flight number...
There's a Mr. Bishara on line 3, said Rachel. Shall I put him through?
Yes, said Seb,
then placed a hand over the mouthpiece and asked his 2 colleagues if they could leave him for a few minutes.
Mr. Clifton, I think it's time we had another game of backgammon.
I'm not sure I can afford it.
In exchange for a lesson, I ask for nothing more than information.
What do you need to know?
Have you ever come across a man by the name of Desmond Mellor?
Yes, I have.
And your opinion of him?
On a scale of 1 to 10?
1. I see. And what about Major Alex Fisher, MP?
-1.
Do you still own 6% of Farthing's Bank?
7%, and those shares are still not for sale.
That's not why I asked. Shall we say 10 o'clock tonight at the Claremont?
Could we make it a little later? I'm taking my Aunt Grace to see Death of a Salesman at the Orbitch, but she always likes to catch the last train back to Cambridge, so I could be with you around 11?
I'm delighted to be stood up in favour of your aunt, Mr. Clifton. I look forward to seeing you at 11 at the Claremont, where we can discuss Death of a Salesman.
Chapter 35.
Arrogance and greed is the answer to your question, spat out Desmond Mellor. You had a banker's draft, cash in hand, but you still weren't satisfied. You wanted more, and because of your stupidity, I'm facing bankruptcy.
I'm sure it's not that bad, Desmond. After all, you still own 51% of Farthing's, not to mention your other considerable assets.
Let me spell it out for you, Sloane, so you're not under any illusions as to what I'm up against, and more important, what I expect you to do about it. I purchased, on your advice, 51% of the bank stock from Arnold Harcastle at a price of £3.09 a share, which cost me just over £20 million. In order to raise that sum, I had to borrow £11 million from my bank, using the shares, all my assets, including 2 homes, as well as having to sign a personal guarantee. Farthing shares are on the market this morning at £2.11, which means I'm showing a shortfall of over £5 million for a deal you said we couldn't lose on. It's just possible I may avoid going bankrupt, but I'll certainly be wiped out if I have to put my shares on the market now, which I repeat is because of your arrogance and greed.
That isn't entirely fair, said Sloane. At the board meeting last Monday, we all agreed, you included, to put the asking price up to £6.
True, but the carpet trader's son called your bluff. He was still willing to go ahead at £5 a share, which would have got me off the hook and provided us all with a handsome profit. So the least you can do is buy my shares for £3.09 and get me out of a situation you're responsible for.
But as I've already explained, Desmond, much as I'd like to help, what you're suggesting would be breaking the law. That didn't seem to worry you when you told Bishara that you had a bid of £6 on the table from a well-established city institution, when no such third party existed. I think you'll find that's also against the law. I repeat, we all agreed.
The phone on Sloane's desk began to ring. He pressed the intercom and barked,
I told you, no interruptions.
It's Lady Virginia Fenwick, and she says it is urgent.
I can't wait to hear what she's got to say, said Mellor. Good morning, Lady Virginia, said Sloane, trying to keep the impatience out of his voice. How nice to hear from you.
You may not feel that way when you know why I'm calling, said Virginia. I've just received a pre-trial invoice from my solicitors for £20,000 that has to be settled before the first day of proceedings. You will recall, Adrian, giving me your word that you would cover the costs of my trial. Pennies in the grand scheme of things, if I remember your words correctly.
I did indeed say that, Lady Virginia, but you will also remember that the offer depended on the successful outcome of our negotiations with Mr. Bishara, so I'm afraid.
But Major Fisher tells me you only have yourself to blame for that remarkable lack of judgment. You may take this as you wish, Mr. Sloane, but if you do not keep your word and cover my legal costs, let me warn you that I am not without influence in the city.
Are you threatening me, Lady Virginia?
As I said, Mr. Sloane, you may take it as you wish.
Virginia slammed down the phone and turned to Fisher.
I'll give him a couple of days to come up with the 20,000. Otherwise,
that man won't part with a penny unless you have a written agreement, and perhaps not even then. It's the way he treats everyone. He promised me a place on the board of Farthings, but since the Bishara deal fell through, I haven't heard a word from him.
Well, I can promise you that he won't be working in the city for much longer if I have anything to do with it. But I'm sorry, Alex, I'm sure that wasn't the reason you wanted to see me.
No, it wasn't. I thought you ought to know that I was issued with a subpoena this morning from Mrs. Clifton's solicitors, putting me on notice that they intend to call me as a witness at your trial.
I'm sorry I'm late, said Seb, as he climbed onto the barstool. When we came out of the theatre, it was raining and I couldn't find a taxi, so I had to drive my aunt to Paddington to make sure she didn't miss the last train.
Worthy of a Boy Scout, said Bishara.
Good evening, sir, said the barman. Campari and soda. Seb was impressed, as he'd only visited the club once before.
Yes, he replied, thank you.
And what does your aunt do in Cambridge?
Asked Bishara.
She's an English don at Newnham. The family's blue stocking. We're very proud of her.
You're so unlike your fellow Englishman.
What makes you say that?
Asked Seb, as a Campari and soda was placed in front of him.
You treat everyone as an equal, from the barman to your aunt, and you don't patronize foreigners like myself. So many Englishmen would have said, my aunt teaches English at Cambridge University, but you took it for granted that I knew what a don is, that Newnham is one of the 5 women's colleges at Cambridge, and that a blue stocking is a girl who aspires to learning. Unlike that patronizing idiot Adrian Sloane, who, because he went to Harrow, thinks he's well-educated.
I get the impression you dislike Sloane almost as much as I do.
Possibly more, after his latest contract when he tried to sell me his bank.
But it's not his bank to sell. At least not as long as Cedric Hardcastle's widow still owns 51% of the stock.
But she doesn't any longer, said Bishara. Desmond Mellor has recently purchased all her shares.
That's not possible, said Seb. Mellor's a wealthy man, but he's not in that league. He'd need 20 million before he could get his hands on 51% of Farthing's stock, and he doesn't have that sort of money.
Could that be the reason the man who was sweating when I was in Farthing's boardroom wants to see me?
Said Bishara, almost as if he was speaking to himself.
Has Mellor overstretched himself? And now that my offer is no longer on the table, does he need to offload his shares?
What offer?
Said Seb, not touching his drink.
I agreed to pay £5 a share for what must have been Arnold Harcastle's stock, or to be more accurate, his mother's. I was just about to sign the contract when Sloane decided to raise the price to £6, so I withdrew my offer, packed up my tent, gathered up my camels, and headed back into the desert.
Seb laughed. But at £5, he and Mellor would both have made a small fortune.
That's my point, Mr. Clifton. You would have honored the deal, not tried to change the price at the last moment. But Sloane only thinks of me as a carpet trader he can take advantage of. But if I can get two questions answered before I see Mellor tomorrow, I could still take over Farthings and, unlike Sloane, I would welcome you onto the board.
What do you need to know?
Was it Mellor who purchased Mrs. Hardcastle's shares, and if so, how much did he pay for them?
I'll give Arnold Hardcastle a call first thing in the morning. But I must warn you, he's a lawyer by profession, and although he hates Sloane almost as much as I do, he would never compromise a client's confidentiality. But that won't stop me trying. What time's your meeting with Mellor?
12 o'clock at my office.
I'll ring you as soon as I've spoken to Arnold Harcastle.
Thank you, said Bishara. Now, on to more important matters. Your first lesson in the dubious art of backgammon. One of the few games you English didn't invent. The most important thing to remember about backgammon is that it's all about percentages. As long as you can calculate the odds after each throw of the dice, you can never be beaten by an inferior opponent. Luck only comes into the equation when two players are equal.
Not unlike banking, said Seb, as the two men took their seats on opposite sides of the board. When Harry opened his eyes, he had such a splitting headache that it was some time before he could focus. He tried to raise his head, but he didn't have the strength. He lay still, feeling as if he was coming round after an anaesthetic. He opened his eyes again and looked up at the ceiling. A concrete block with several cracks in it, one producing a slow drip of water, like a tap that hadn't been properly turned off. He turned his head slowly to his left. The condensation on the wall was so close that he could have touched it if he hadn't been handcuffed to the bed. He turned the other way to see a door with a square window in it, through which he could, like Alice, have escaped if there hadn't been three iron bars across it and two guards standing on the other side. He tried to move his feet, but they were also clamped to the bed. Why such precautions for an Englishman who had been caught with a banned book? Although the first seven chapters had been fascinating, he sensed that he hadn't yet discovered the real reason every copy had been destroyed, which only made him even more determined to read the remaining 14 chapters. They might also explain why he was being treated as if he were a double agent or a mass murderer. Harry had no way of knowing how long he'd been in the cell. His watch had been removed, and he couldn't even be sure if it was night or day. He started singing God Save the Queen, not as an act of defiant patriotism, but more because he wanted to hear the sound of his own voice. Actually, if you'd asked him, Harry would have admitted he preferred the Russian national anthem. Two eyes peered through the bars, but he ignored them and continued singing. Then he heard someone shouting a command, and moments later the door swung open, and Colonel Marinkin reappeared, accompanied by his two Rottweilers.
Mr. Clifton, I must apologize for the state of your accommodation. It's just that we didn't want anyone to know where you were before we released you.
The words, released you, sounded to Harry like Gabriel's horn.
Let me assure you, we have no desire to keep you any longer than necessary. Just some paperwork to complete, and a statement for you to sign, and then you can be on your way.
A statement? What kind of statement?
More of a confession, admitted the colonel. But once you've signed it, you will be driven back to the airport and be on your way home.
And if I refuse to sign it?
That would be remarkably foolish, Mr. Clifton, because you would then face a trial at which the charge, the verdict, and the sentence have already been decided. You once described the show trial in one of your books. You will be able to give a much more accurate portrayal when you write your next novel. he paused, in 12 years' time.
What about the jury?